Okay, before we start James 5, look back at chapter 4, verse 17. Last thing we talked about when we studied our class on James. It says, therefore, to him who knows to do good and does not do it, to him it is sin. And Tim and I were talking afterwards. This was last Wednesday when we studied that. We get that. We get that verse. We understand what it means, right? To him who knows to do good. Here's an opportunity to do good. I'm provided with that opportunity. I have the ability to do it. If I just don't do it, what am I being told here? Yet, we often think about it, okay, I'm avoiding committing sin. Okay, this is sin, I'm going to avoid it. This is wrong, I'm going to avoid it. Here's the other side of it. Here's something good that should be done, and I can do it. I have the opportunity to do it, and I just choose not to. That's also missing the mark. One of the things we were talking about was, that verse is almost always isolated, isn't it? When that's quoted, it's that verse. Nobody quotes it in context of what's going on. And so we were just kind of talking afterwards and thinking, why is it here? Why is it in this spot? And so I was thinking, well, we're going to get deep here. We got to go through this and let's think about this thing deeply. And that may be the case. And if you've done that, good. What struck me earlier is, I think this is easy. I think the reasoning behind it is actually very, very simple. Go back to 13 through 16. What are some of the main points there? As you go through, life is short, right? It's so short we don't know when it's going to end. What is it described as?
A vapor.
It's like a vapor. We know what that is. That's smoke. You run your fingers through it and it's here and then it's gone. And so, because we don't know what the future holds, what should we be busy doing?
Trying to get it right.
Good. Right? Isn't that the idea behind verse 17? Do good. I don't have much time. What does God expect me to be doing with what little time I have left? Do good. With the opportunities that's presented to me, it's easy to say, you know what? I'll catch it next time. I'll catch it next time. That guy over there, and Brent brought it up in one of his lessons. Here he is. He's asking for money. You know, I'll catch him next week. I'll catch it. What do I need to do? Do good. As you have opportunity, do those things. And so I wonder if the connection is much simpler than maybe I was trying to make it. Do we know what's good?
Yes.
Do we know what's right?
Yes.
Then do it. As we have those opportunities. As he's closing this letter down, that would be a really powerful impact on the people reading this, especially in consideration with some of the problems that they're having. And now let's shift over into chapter 5. Any thoughts on that before we go into it? Yeah, Tim, go ahead.
Titus 3, verse 1, talks about that in particular. And Paul is asking Titus to teach them to be ready to do every good work. And so, like the example of the person on the side of this road, if you think about it, it occurs to us that there will be people who have need. And in the past, I have been all too easy with the idea, well, I just don't carry cash. I'm sorry, you're out of luck. And if it was a bad enough occasion, okay, I'll go with you, you know, and pay for your groceries or whatever. But instead, if I'm ready, I'll prepare and have bills in my pocket to do those good works. And that's the difference between looking for a way out and being self-focused.
Maybe that's another aspect of it too. Do I look to do good works? Or am I just kind of going along, and when the opportunity to do a good work hits me in the face and grabs me in a chokehold and won't let me go, I say, okay, I give up. I'll do it. Or am I honestly looking? I want it to come. Do you want those opportunities to come? Honest answer. Sometimes I'm afraid the answer is, no, leave me alone. My day is packed. I've got stuff to do. I don't have time to work this in. That's the honest answer. I got to get better at that. Do we look? Are we excited about the opportunity to do good things? Good. Thank you, Tim. Good. Brian.
I think all we have to do is look to Jesus. He could do anything. And look at all the people coming to him with infirmities and evil spirits or whatever. He couldn't get to all of them. But he would if he had the time. I think God knows you're limited in our time. We are as a labor. But when our events show themselves, we need to be prepared to have the mindset of Christ.
I think one of the biggest things that stands out with him is his compassion. And we see that over and over again. Jesus looked upon them and had compassion on them. I need to be better at being compassionate. That other stuff will fall into place. And I will. I'll make time. I'll set things up if my compassion is like my Lord's and where it needs to be. And go ahead.
So I would also challenge us, not only would we be ready physically to do the work, whether there's bills in our pocket or that sort of stuff, but be prepared mentally to further the gospel and spiritually enhance those people through that where you help them. Having a plan, having knowledge, and being ready to teach based upon whatever that individual is. You know, one size doesn't fit all. So you got to think through it a little bit, but you need to be prepared for that piece of it. So, I mean, I think what Brian's talking about, Jesus did it, but his end game wasn't the physical health.
Yeah.
That was the mechanism to teach them spiritually something every time.
I think all of us can get better at that. Working evangelism into the conversations that we have with others. If you give someone some money, let's use the same guy again, he's asking for money for food, and you give it to him and he says thank you, think of some ways we could respond to that. God has blessed me to be able to do this, and he would want me to do it. Now, does that open up a conversation that you're welcome just doesn't open up? Thank you. Well, you're welcome. Thank you. I'm glad God let me do it. Completely different thing. We can keep that thing going. And I think sometimes, and maybe it's nervousness, maybe it's our society, I don't know what it is, we just kind of, we have the opportunity, we do the right thing, and then we just shut it down. Jesus didn't. He, like Andy said, what was his end game?
He's trying to bring them home.
He's looking for souls. Am I looking for souls? All right, just something to consider. Good, thank you, guys. Yeah, Liz.
I think this goes farther than just material helping people. If you know it's good to have the right kind of conversation with a person instead of being upset with them and you don't do it, that's sin. I think it covers our whole aspect of life. We know what's right and we know what's wrong. And when we do what is wrong, but we know what's right, whether it's the way we talk to people, the way we treat people, it certainly in helping people with this thing is part of it. But I think this goes a lot farther than that.
Yeah. I think you can apply it to... Can you apply it to worship?
Yes.
Is it good for me to gather with the saints to worship the Lord and partake of the Lord's Supper on the first day of the week? Do I know it's good?
Yes.
What if I just choose not to do it? Now, I'm not sick. I'm not sick, and I'm not somehow, no legs broken and I can't come. I could come. I could absolutely, and I just choose to do something else. Would that play into this?
I think so.
I think you make that application too. So, yeah, Les is right. This is, let's not pigeonhole it. This principle, boy, that'll open your eyes. We're constantly having these opportunities to look to do these things. Good. Okay. I don't want to get us totally sidetracked. Let's get into 5. And move through there. You remember in 13 through 17, James has mentioned this idea of these prideful merchants. They're making these business decisions without ever giving any thought to God in the matter at all. Well, in chapter 5, verses 1 through 6, he continues to deal with issues concerning worldly riches. He's particularly focusing on the rich who take advantage of others, and that's how they got their riches. So let's look at 1 through 6 and then come back and make some applications there. Verse 1, "Come now, you rich, weep and howl for your miseries that are coming upon you." How about that to open a chapter? How would the rich normally feel?
Happy because they got all that money and they're like all powerful.
What does he tell them? It's coming.
Miseries are coming.
Misery. Just look at the language there. Weep and howl for the miseries that are coming upon you. He tells why. Your riches are corrupted. Your garments are moth-eaten. Your gold and your silver are corroded, and their corrosion will be a witness against you and will eat your flesh like fire. You have heaped up treasure in the last days. We'll come back and make more points of this. This is loaded with applications we can make. Verse 4, indeed, the wages of the laborers who mowed your fields, which you kept back by fraud, cry out. And the cries of the reapers have reached the ears of the Lord of Sabaoth. You have lived on the earth in pleasure and luxury. You have fattened your hearts as in a day of slaughter. You have condemned, you have murdered the just. He does not resist you. This is a huge accusation against these who are rich. How did they get their riches? This is important to the whole conversation. This is really an integral point. How did they get it?
Fraud down there.
Yeah, fraud is the word used there. They defrauded. They cheated people to get this. There were those who did honest labor for them, expecting honest pay, and what did they do? Yeah, they ripped them off. But who saw it? They cry out that you mistreat me like that. God saw it. The Lord of Sabaoth saw it. Keep going through there. Imagine, and I just have to think of this. Imagine the trouble that a Christian obsessed with riches and obtaining riches at any cost. Imagine the trouble he's going to have in this life. What's his foundation going to be? How steady is he going to be through this life? If his obsession, his God, becomes mammon, what's it going to be like?
He's going to do whatever he can for.
What has he chosen? He's chosen another master, hadn't he? He's worshiping another God. I think this is the exact same point that Jesus is making back in Matthew 6, verse 24. You can't serve two masters. You will love one and hate the other. You cannot serve God and mammon, which is that worldly riches. The rich are to howl because of the disaster. Notice verses 2 through 3. It doesn't matter what kind of wealth they have. If they have grain, what's going to happen to it? Verse 2, first part. It'll be rotted. It'll be corrupted. What if they have fine clothing? What's going to happen to that? Moths will get that. What if they have actual coin? It'll corrode. It's going to corrode too. No matter what constitutes those riches, it won't survive. It will not last. The point is, since these things won't last, you can't trust in them. And when you get to the end of the line, where's the stuff going to go? Where are you going to go?
Going to somebody else.
I'm still going to be here, and you're going to go.
And you're not. Yeah. And then ultimately, let's get to the end of the line. What's going to happen to the world? It will be burned up. What's going to happen to your stuff? If it's still around, it's going to burn too. So it's this temporary thing. And to make that temporary our God extremely dangerous. Notice what he says, the last part of verse 3. You have heaped up treasure in the last days. This is not a compliment. This is not something he's looking to them and saying, good job, guys. Go back to Matthew 6. I think that this is, again, the same point that Matthew addresses there. I think the point that James makes there in 5:3 is the same thing that Jesus makes in 6:19. Jesus is also talking about laying up treasures. But what does he say? Somebody read that for us, please. 6:19 in Matthew.
Lay not up for yourselves treasures upon earth, where moth and rust doth corrupt, and where thieves break through and steal.
Go ahead and read 20 through 21, Mary.
But lay up for yourselves treasures in heaven, where neither moth nor rust doth corrupt, and where the thieves do not break through nor steal. Where your treasure is, there will your heart be also.
Okay, think of the guys he's talking about, those rich who have used just whatever kind of ways they could cheat others to get the money. Where have they laid their treasures up? Using this comparison. In the earth, right? They've laid up those worldly, those earthly treasures. What's the problem? Wrong place. Wrong place. Because no matter what you do with those things, they can be lost. Again, there's that temporary aspect of those things being emphasized there. Go back to James 5. Well, I said, go back to James 5. There's one point there, Matthew 6, before we leave it. Look at verse 33. instead of all that. You know, he deals with the idea of worrying. You know, you worry about what you're going to wear and what you're going to eat and all of this stuff. The real focus of this conversation is there in chapter 6, verse 33. But seek first the kingdom of God and His righteousness, and all these other things will be added to you. So the focus is to be the spiritual, is to be God's things and not these temporary things that will come and go. And then just like us, we talked about our lives being a vapor. These things will one day be lost as well. Notice, let's see, back in James. Verse 4, their cries go out to the Lord of Sabaoth. Some of your verses may, or some of your versions, excuse me, may say Lord of Hosts. You have that there? Someone, I think maybe English Standard gives that one. The Lord of Hosts. Have you seen that phrase before? Old Testament is loaded with it. If you have a New King James Version, it's, if I remember right, it's 272 times the Lord of Hosts is used in the Old Testament. So it is something, a phrase, a description of God we're familiar with. What kind of host is it talking about when it's used? It's a powerful verse, or a powerful descriptor, excuse me, of God. Yeah, Bobby?
The heavenly host.
The heavenly host. Okay, now what's that?
Usually an army of vengeance.
Yeah. Okay. This is when you see that phrase, Lord of Hosts, there is usually the idea of vengeance in mind. He is the Lord of the heavenly host, the angelic host. Can they do some damage? I think about Sennacherib, you know, and just one. Just one. What, 185,000? Am I remembering that number right? 185,000 one night. Sennacherib, king of Assyria, he comes and he has just threatened Judah and threatened him and threatened him and threatened him. Don't listen to Hezekiah as he tells you to go worship God. Do you see what I've done to everybody else? I'm going to do it to you too. And then he goes to sleep that night. And then he wakes up and 185,000 soldiers dead. What does he do? Do you remember? He goes home. That's what he does. He goes home and prays to his false god. I think Nisroch was the god he was praying to. You remember what happens there? Two of his sons murder him right there in the temple. Yeah, so that's how it works out for him. The Lord of Hosts. The Lord of that godly and heavenly vengeance. It's a fearsome title. It shows his wrath. Man, that's the word I've been looking for. It embodies it. Now bring all of that Old Testament experience back to here. You cheated these who did honest work for you. They cry out, and who do they cry out to? The Lord of Hosts. You don't want none of that. That is something you can't stand against. What's going to happen to these if they don't repent?
They're going to have to face that.
They will absolutely be destroyed in eternity. You can't stand against that kind of power. And that's what we see here. He goes on to tell them, you've lived on the earth in pleasure. You've lived in luxury, taking advantage of these others. You fattened your hearts as a day of slaughter. It's like the pig just fattening himself up for the day when slaughter comes. Great imagery that's used throughout here. Good. We'll move through 7 through 12, but I'll stop for a second. Any thoughts on those you want to say? Yeah, Terry, go ahead.
In Proverbs 28:20, it says, a faithful man shall abound with blessing, but he that makes haste to be rich shall not be innocent. Then in 22 it says, he that hastes to be rich has an evil eye, and consider not that poverty shall come upon him.
Does not consider that poverty will come upon him. Why so often does poverty come upon the one that, I think it's fair to say, lust? He lusts after these riches. He lusts after wealth. And that's the heart we're talking about. That's willing. That desire is so consuming to them. They're willing to do whatever it takes. And in James's example, cheat others to get it. What happens to him so often?
Look at all the people who win the lottery.
Yeah.
All those sweepstakes. Most of them, the majority of them, end up poorer than when they started out. Because they're fools and they're greedy.
Worse than when it started.
Theirs.
Yeah.
Or keep turning around and sticking it right back in those machines trying to get more.
Yeah.
It's, okay.
I talking to someone that very, very dear to me who has a problem with that, and she said, I made a goal for myself. After I won this, I wasn't gonna give it back. And I said, well, yeah, what happened? She said, well, I gave it back. And yeah, and what I told her was, they know that. They know that. She said, but they gave me a free dinner ticket, and they gave me tickets to the concert. I'm like, oh, they weren't free. But you paid for that months ago. These guys aren't fools. They don't build and pay off $15 million buildings in 1 year by accident. This is, they're preying on that idea of, I gotta have it. I've gotta have it. This is what I want. And if I can just get this, what will it do for me? Here's the lie that Satan tells us. If I can just have this, it'll be perfect. Everything will be great. And then the reality is, it can't bring that joy. It can't heal those wounds and fill those holes that we need. Go ahead, Bobby.
I've heard of situations kind of like that, where people hire some illegals to work on a building for them, and when it comes time to pay, they call the police and get them set that.
So they don't have to pay them.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
Wow. Yeah, I had a guy do that to me one time.
Wow. Yeah. Mm. What leads to that, by the way?
What?
Okay. I don't want to part with this. I want you to do this for me. I want you to mow my fields, but I don't really want to part with this. And I'll find a way to get around it. It does come back to a heart consumed greed. Matt, did you have?
I just when we talking about this, and I always think of professional athletes. It blows my mind how greedy they become, and you watch them with their contract negotiations, but then you see these ones, they make 20, 30 million a year and they go bankrupt, you know, and how do they do it? It's beyond me, but just talking about these scriptures with the rich and how greedy they get, it's unbelievable.
It will blind me. And it will blind you if we let it, certainly and easily. That's why there's so many warnings against it, Old Testament and New. Pick up in 7. Let's move through. I want to get us a little farther into, a little deeper into this. Verse 7. Therefore, be patient, brethren, until the coming of the Lord. See how the farmer waits for the precious fruit of the earth, waiting patiently for it until it receives the early and latter rain. You also be patient. Establish your hearts, for the coming of the Lord is at hand. Do not grumble against one another, brethren, lest you be condemned. Behold, the judge is standing at the door. My brethren, take the prophets who spoke in the name of the Lord as an example of suffering and patience. Indeed, we count them blessed who endure. You have heard of the perseverance of Job, and you've seen the end intended by the Lord, that the Lord is very compassionate and merciful. But above all, my brethren, do not swear either by heaven or by earth or with any other oath, but let your yes be yes and your no, no, lest you fall into judgment. James returns to the theme that he's talked about earlier throughout the book. If you go back to chapter 1, verse 12, he talks about blessed is the man who endures temptation. And you're going to see a lot of that here. When persecution and troubles come, blessed is the man who is patient, who endures it and goes through it. He's just described how the oppressive rich will end up. What does he tell brethren now that they need to do? Be patient. And the oppressive rich put their trust and their dependence on the stuff. Where does he bring them back? Where does he tell them to go?
Drive on the day of the Lord when it's coming, and the judgment is going to come with that.
You can rest assured God sees it and judgment will come. You focus on that. That's what this patience is being about. Does the Lord see these inequities in life? Absolutely does. No question about that. Will he take care of them? Will he do it justly? And so the idea here is, wait on him. That is one of the hardest things we will do as Christians, is wait on the Lord. And it's something that we ought to know that it works out. Because when you do it, what happens? It always works out. Because he knows and he is faithful, and not only does he have good intentions, he has the power to back them up. He's never let us down, and yet what do? So often, when he expects us to wait, we, like Sarah, go get our handmaiden and take Hagar to Abraham and decide to help God out. And how does that work out? Trouble. Is he trustworthy? He is. We know this. And yet, and maybe it is that we recognize that we're vapors. And so we want it now. We want it quick. We don't want to be patient. But that's part of faith. And James, going back, taking that back to chapter 2. Faith without works is dead. What are one of the works? What is one of the works that we will do if our faith is what it is? Should it be? We'll be patient. Yeah, nobody likes to hear that. But it is true there. J.W., go ahead.
Yeah, Paul was telling Timothy in chapter 6, verse 6, verse 9, but they that will be rich, all of his temptation is now, and do many foolish lusts, and hurtful lusts. And you see this all the time. This happened to Solomon. You know, he went after wealth, riches, fame, and this what happened to him. The snare is something like a trap. You know, when you get in that trap, you can't get out. It's something like a whale, a spider whale. You get hung, a fly or something, you get hung in there, you know you can't go nowhere else. And the spider just takes its time and divides. That's what Satan do to men of riches.
Yeah.
That love riches.
Yeah, I think that's the key there. Go ahead, Tim.
That's why I try not to use words like faith and believe, but trust instead. Because trust has this as its necessary component of time and waiting. If you trust God, mm-hmm. as opposed to just an acknowledgement of fact, then you're going to be able to not just depend on Him, but endure, which is both of these hinges that James is trying to get us to see. Both to be patient, but to also endure.
What are some of the examples he uses of that? He doesn't expect them to do something they've never seen before. Have they heard of examples of this very patience he's talking about?
Job.
Yeah, Job is the one mentioned. You've heard of the perseverance of Job. Absolutely. Who else is mentioned there?
Farmer.
I think there's one more. Verse 10. Prophets. Yeah. Take the prophets. Did they endure persecution? You think about it. Boy, Jeremiah. And just the stuff that they went through over and over. Were they doing right? Absolutely. They loved the Lord and they did right. And more trouble came to them because of that. Yet, did God see their situation? Did He have an answer for it? Do you think today, and I know this is a do you think, but do you think today they're glad they did what they did? You think Jeremiah is glad at this moment, if you could talk to him, that he continued to follow the Lord? No question in my mind. We know that. And that's why these examples are offered up for us. They trusted him, and he proved that he is who he says he is. He is faithful and trustworthy. Now look down, verse 12. This idea of, as we say, your word is your bond. Remember the cautions of James 3. I don't think we're getting away from that here. And the misuse of the tongue. Here is one way we can misuse our tongue, right? We can say we're going to do one thing. We can give our word to do one thing. And what do? What does that cause? If you and I are known as somebody who is not trustworthy when it comes to giving their word, what does that do?
It causes you to be upset for more because they ain't on time.
It damages your reputation.
How big is that? How effective are you and I going to be as teachers of the gospel if we have a poor reputation, an untrustworthy reputation? Why would somebody trust you and me with their souls if they can't trust us when we tell them we'll do this or that? If they can't trust us with day-to-day stuff, and I think they're going to sit down and trust what I have to say about this book and about eternity, it's not going to happen. It's simply not going to happen. It is so important for us to do this. Do we mess up sometimes? So what do you do then? Come clean. When anyone has ever done that, they said something to you and they broke it, but they just came clean with you. And it's obvious that it wasn't intentional. It's obviously they want to make it right. Can you do that? Can you forgive them and respect them for that? I can. What if they try to start coming up with excuses and say, well, let me tell you what happened. Eve brought me that thing. You know, Eve that you gave me. She's what happens for your respect for them in that moment? Oh, please. You just won't fess up. You just won't accept and admit the truth. We don't have any respect for that. Certainly need to keep that in mind as we're teaching others as well. The power of words to influence others is huge. And I have this in my notes here. Am I trustworthy? This is a simple question. But you and I need to ask it of ourselves. Are you trustworthy? Are we really? When we say it, to the best of my ability, I'll do it. That's what God expects His people to be. It is simple. It really is simple. The principle, the concept is we have to stay focused and not let things pull us this way and that. We can do this. This is certainly, it is doable, and it has so many implications. Okay. We've got 10 minutes. I want to get into this last section. Starting in verse 13. Is any among you suffering? Let him pray. Is anyone cheerful? Let him sing songs. In verse 14. Is anyone among you sick? Let him call for the elders of the church and let them pray over him, anointing him with oil in the name of the Lord. And the prayer of faith will save the sick, and the Lord will raise him up. If he has committed sins, he will be forgiven. Confess your trespasses to one another and pray for one another that you might be healed. The effective, fervent prayer of a righteous man avails much. I want to stop there. He gives an example to go with that in Elijah, and we might have time for that, but probably not. Are you suffering? What's the answer? What do you do?
Pray.
It seems so easy, and I think we take prayer for granted. It is powerful. And this last section is really focusing on that. That's why he's going to bring Elijah into it and talk about the stoppage of rain for 3.5 years. Prayer is not casual. Prayer is not something you just throw as an afterthought and, well, man, we've done everything else we can. I guess we'll pray for you. Maybe that'll... And no! That's not it at all. It is extremely powerful. It's something... Who has the ability to do it? What do you have to have before your prayer can be heard?
Faithful.
Relationship with God. That is important. It is special. If we're willing to have that, who is it available to? All. For whosoever will. Anyone who will humble themselves and be obedient so that relationship can be established. Now, instead of praying when hardship comes, what is it easy to get caught up in the trap of doing? When hardship comes to you, when it's on your shoulders and it hits you, what is the trap?
Pity, self-pity.
Why me, oh Lord? Why me? I've been trying to do right. I've been trying to do what you've asked. I've done this, and I've praised you, and I've taught other people about you, and I've always done this, and why me? Why is this happening to me now? What should I be asking him for? Instead of why me, what should I be asking? Help. Help. And yet, what I'm really doing is making an accusation against him instead of asking him. And I've just thought of this lately, and maybe what I need to ask is, why not me? What makes me any better? What makes me too good that I don't have to go through it? Is my problem, whatever it is it an opportunity to glorify the Lord? When trouble comes my way, is it a chance to bring glory to my Lord? I'll give you a couple examples just from people I know. If we took the attitude of saying, help me through this, Lord, and help this event, as bad as it is, help it to glorify you. I can think of two preachers over the past year and a half who have lost children. One of them was an adult son who drowned. The other one was, he was three, a little boy, had cancer issues. I know one of them pretty well. The other one I know of. That next Sunday, they stood in the pulpit after losing their boys and preached sound sermons and glorified the Lord. Now let me ask you, does that do good for the kingdom? Here is somebody who has lost what worldly speaking, is one of the most precious things. And yet, what does he do when he has the opportunity to stand before other people? What does he tell them? God is worthy. He's a good God. He wants us to have a relationship with Him. I want you to have a relationship with Him. He just lost His Son. Does that get your attention? Is that powerful? What if those guys had taken the opposite approach and said, Lord, I can't even talk to you. I've done everything I could. I've done everything you told me to. I've tried to do this, and now you hit me with this. I've got nothing for you. What would that do to all the people around them? Could crush their faith. Nobody wants to go through it. I'm not saying, and I'm not asking that something terrible happened to me. Believe me. But when it does, can I take that attitude instead of the blaming God part? We will be well used if we're willing to do that. Is it hard? Yes. Yes, it is. He's done a lot of hard things for us too. Bobby.
But if we think about losing somebody the right way, if they are in the right relationship with God, when we lose them, they just got to where we are trying to get to before we get there.
It would certainly make it a whole lot easier to be able to preach a lesson like that. It certainly would. Terry, you had something too.
Yes, a lot of times we may forget that, you know, we are the one in debt. And sometimes we go to Him like He owes us something. We complain that, Lord, I've been doing this, I've been doing that. So keep on doing it, because you are paying a debt off. You are indebted to Him. You have had your sins removed. There's nothing you can do to repay it. So the only thing you can do is keep on doing it.
Interesting.
He owes you nothing.
Yeah, interesting that Job is brought up here. I talked about losing children. What does Job lose?
All of them.
I mean, everything and all of them. And yet, what attitude does he take?
Lord, give it and Lord, take it.
I got them from God. And this is hard for us, because this is emotionally... this is real emotional connection. He did give them to me. Right? No matter what happens to them, does it change the fact that He gave them to me? That's hard. I understand. And we are emotional when the loss comes. And you've been through it. We've been through it. We've been through loss. Do I love Him more than even them? Man, that's what the question comes back to. Is if we can get to that point, how much can we do for His kingdom? Keep on going through. Now 14 and 15... Getting short on time here, but these two verses, brethren, take them a few different ways. I'm going to lay them out here a couple of different ways that I have heard these explained. The first one is that the elders during this age, these elders being spoken of here, would have had miraculous spiritual gifts. And so with the anointing of oil, that would have been symbolic. An apostle laid hands on these elders. They would have had miraculous spiritual gifts. And so they would come and pray and have a miraculous ability to heal the sick. And a lot of times when someone uses that as the explanation, they go to Mark 6:13, where you've got the disciples going out and anointing with oil and casting out evil spirits. So that's one way to consider it. Another is that the sickness is physical, but it has spiritual complications from it. So there's a physical sickness, but it has damaged the spirit of the person. You know, they're so beaten up over this that it's really becoming a part where sin can creep in. Call for the elders and have them pray over him. Oil was widely used as medicine at the time, so today a similar application might be pray. And then use the medicine that you have available, but prayer in that. And I was talking with my friend Tad this morning, because I have just been all over the place on this verse this week. I'll be honest with you. And he asked me a question. He said, would anybody think that this sickness is physical if the oil wasn't mentioned? Could the sickness referred to here be spiritual? If that's the case, does it make sense that the elders would be called? Because their primary function is to deal with what kind of issues? spiritual issues. So I think he may be onto something there. If someone were spiritually weak, I mean, let's say they're struggling. They're struggling with an issue. Let's not say that they're full blown given over into sin, but they are struggling. Would that count as being spiritually sick? You're just getting hammered with it, and you're not where you need to be. I mean, you're not full blown rebellion, but it is beating down on you. Would that qualify as being sick? Certainly spiritually, I think it could. Regardless of how you take that. What is the focus of these five or six verses? What is the emphasis? Again, starting in 13. And then when you pick up right after those two in 16, and then the example in 17, especially 16. What is the focus of this section?
Prayer.
The power of prayer. But not just anybody's prayer. The effective, fervent prayer of a righteous man. Can we learn from that? Now let's think about some of the... This is a prayer of faith, and that is the key point here. God hears those prayers. He hears those offered up by His people. Now, let's think of it from a couple of different ways. I need to be clean so God will hear my prayers for myself. I also need to be clean so God will hear my prayers for who else? That's big, isn't it? Because if I'm allowing some sin to get in the way between me and God, I'm not just hurting myself and hurting God. I'm also hurting you. Because when you come to me and ask me to pray, of course I'm going to say yes, but I'm struggling in this sin. I can go pray until my face turns blue. Until I get rid of the sin, where's my prayer? Where's it going? I'm supposed to hit the roof and bouncing back down. It's not going before God's throne because I have that there and I just won't deal with it. Now, I'm hurting you. And this, we've talked about this idea, and Brent, I love the way that he emphasized the spiritual family that we have. Don't we see this responsibility to each other too in our prayer life? Do you pray for these guys? Do you pray for these? I would recommend this to you if you don't do it. Instead of praying for the saints at Eastside, pray for the saints at Eastside individually and by name. It might take you a little while, but just go down the rows. And look at those faces in your mind's eye and think about what they're going through that you know of and pray for them. And it will make you closer to this group here. It will help us keep these things the way we need to keep them. Let's see. I have one more point I want to make here. Okay, also, make one more point about 16. We'll pick up on Sunday. We can talk more about this. But confess your trespasses to one another. Pray for one another that you might be healed. The effective, fervent prayer of a righteous man avails much. We'll pick up Sunday. Thank you, guys.